Yes, good morning. Okay, so what we're going to do is we are going to today be starting Parshas Korach. We spoke about it and we're actually going to start it. Korach, the new Parsha. But just one small thing before we start, because today is actually every day is very special. And when you go into the Hasidic calendar, you get even more special days. But today is a very special day, and I actually have a personal connection. It is the 22nd day of Shvat, which is the yahrzeit of the Rebbetzin, of the Lubavitch Rebbe's wife, the present one, Rebbetzin Chaim Mushka, who passed away 35 years ago. And I actually had a chance to meet her. She was a very, very private woman. That's what she was known to be, and she was. Her husband was so public and, you know, and so known and so constantly, in a way almost constantly accessible, but constantly there. And she was always behind the scenes. She kept her privacy, was very, very important to her. But I was lucky enough because, I don't know exactly the connection, but Michal's family somehow had a connection, and when I got engaged, actually went up just after we got married, I went with my in-laws and Michal, and we had tea at her house. And she served tea in a very gracious way. She was very, with a beautiful china that she brought from Russia, the Royal Dalton, you know, just magnificent. Everything was set beautifully. She was, and putting it into context, this was about just a year before she passed away. And she was not so well. She was 87, not her age, but she wasn't so well. And yet she was such a gracious hostess. She made sure everything was perfect, exact, and not just that, but she gave each and every person individual attention. That was what she was, just a gracious, incredibly special woman that way, very sensitive and very, very intelligent woman. She was very well read. Even in that little few minutes that we were there, so my in-laws from South Africa, so she was asking about the situation in South Africa, like she knew everything that's going on everywhere. She was asking Michal and I what we planned to do, and, you know, being young and whatever, stupid and whatever. So I said, oh, well, for sure, we're going to go on Shlichus, you know, and like as if, you know, it's so easy. And she says, you know, Shlichus is hard. Like she was, yeah, just don't be so flippant about everything, you know, and that, but she didn't say it in a bad way, but... But the beautiful thing is that my sister-in-law, also Michal's youngest sister, so she was, I think, 11 or 12 at the time, and she came in with us as well. And my mother-in-law, it's a famous story, but just quickly to share again, my mother-in-law asked, the Rebbetzin asked my sister-in-law, what does she like about America, you know, coming from South Africa? So my mother-in-law answered first, oh, she loves the nash. Because in those days in South Africa, you didn't get that much. Only before Pesach, Michal always says, they used to bring all the chocolates. But otherwise, you didn't have that much treats as just, definitely not as much as in America. So the Rebbetzin was very, so she called over her helper and she said to him, upstairs, I don't know where there was, bring a box of chocolate. And she gave a box of chocolate for my sister-in-law officially to take back. Very nice. A few months later, there was a bacher whose family was very quite close to the Rebbetzin and used to go in. He was traveling to South Africa to study there. And she called him and she asked him to take a package from her for my in-laws. Well, when he gets to the airport, he already calls my in-laws that he has this is a very special thing, a package for the from the Rebbetzin. Anyways, my father-in-law was just trying to figure out what could the Rebbetzin be sending. Maybe she found some old safer. It was a box of chocolate, which is quite incredible, considering that we're talking a few months later, a woman who passed away a few months after that, not a young woman. I mean, they weren't so close in that way, and still to remember... Yes, so there was a sort of mechatonim relation, but it was also because of Winnie's father, my father-in-law, Rabbi Aloy, being who he was, and he also used to go in, so and the Gerari, so from both sides there was a connection, but like I say, not a strong personal connection in that way. There were people who were much more, you know, you might say friends, of you, whatever you want to put it, but it was just incredible, really. And Michal just brought back the box now from the chocolates. We still have the box. He just brought it back when he came back now. But just the sensitivity, and she was known for that incredible sensitivity. And besides being such an intelligent, highly intelligent, really regal woman and so sensitive to everybody's needs. And putting in context also that she didn't have, I know it's always easy for us to say it that way, but she did not have an easy life in any sense of the word. Even from when she was younger, her parents were in Russia. They had to move from one city to the next. Her father was, being who he was hounded by the government. She, actually, when her father was sentenced to be in exile, he chose her to go with him. She was about 20, 21 at the time, and he wanted specifically her to join him. Obviously, she had something about her that he felt that she could be the one that would, you know, be able to accomplish what he wanted, or, you know, have that security. So I'm just going to mute this. And we know, unfortunately, she had two sisters, one older, one younger. And her sister that was older than her, Shaina, was killed in Treblinka. She actually didn't get out in time. So she lost her sister, and she was very close to her. She lost her sister in the war. She herself never had children. As we know, the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin never had their own children. But she was just a woman full of joy. And just to quickly finish, I don't know if the word is joy, but just knew how to appreciate life in every single sense of the word. And there's a very cute story that actually, now talk about related, that they became mechatanim, whatever, through my brother's mechatanim. A cute story, there was a person who owned a store in Crown Heights. He had a grocery store and he used to send deliveries. And one time he decided, why should he send a delivery first? And he'll send his granddaughters. So he sent his granddaughters with, a few small things. And they went around to the house of the Rebbe and the Rebbetzin. They went around the back, knocked on the door, and the Rebbetzin answered the door. And she was very gracious, and she invited them in, I think, and she thanked them for bringing the delivery. And she said to them, "Don't forget, girls, enjoy life." And it sounds like, but it was just, and they, till today, they both have on their fridge, you know, this thing, enjoy. And it's such an important thing, especially as we mature and as life, you know, takes over. We just have to always remember that there has to be that pleasure, that simcha that we put into everything that we do. So just a small little thing about it. So today's her yahrzeit. And also my specific connection is that I got married, I saw the Rebbetzin, and then a year later she passed away. And the day that she passed away in New York was a very late Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning, Chaf Beis Shvat. My Mushkala was born a few hours later. I was in Morristown, and so that was Wednesday. So Thursday, Michal traveled into New York, and the Rebbe was in his house. That's where he was sitting Shiva, and he had his minyanim, and he named Mushkala at the minyan by the Rebbe. So she was the first one named after Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka. Interesting, I personally didn't know, because I had just had a cesarean. I had a very hard labor and a very hard birth, and they all rushed off. I mean, they thought I was sleeping, whatever. It was like 7 in the morning. They all rushed off to New York, not telling me anything. In those days, no cell phones, so they thought that I would be okay. But it was a room. I was it's a beautiful hospital in Morristown, but it was a two-people room, and the person next to me in the bed put on the television. They were watching television, and on the news comes Rebbe Tzinchaya Mushka Schneerson, and they start talking about it. And I was all alone, and I had nobody to call. So it was a bit of a mistake that they didn't tell me. But anyways, so that's how I found out that she had passed away. What? On the television, yes, from the neighbors. Anyways, but also fascinatingly, that when, so Michal was getting up to give Mushkala her name, and the Rebbetzin's name was Chaya Mushka, my grandmother was alive, and her name was Chaya Itta. So my husband thought, no, can't give the name, we're not Tzvardim, so he'll just name Mushka. So he says to the person giving the name, his name was Rabbi Raskin, David Raskin, he said, the name is, and he asked him, and I don't know, maybe he, I'm not sure if he didn't hear, or if he made believe he didn't hear, but Michal said Mushka, and he said Chaya Mushka. So when afterwards, like, we were worried, you know, my grandmother, she's, I didn't think you would do anything different. She was just so gracious, and it was just no problem at all. But it was just very... So that's her name, Chaya Mushka. So she's, yeah, so that's our special connection. But so I guess to take a few things, just the sensitivity and that ability, as we say, enjoy life, even though things are not so amazing around us. And, you know, things don't go the way we want them to and the way we plan them to. That's a very big one. And just one quick other thing that we know, and this is also a big one, is that, she, as I say, she always stayed behind the scenes. And in a sense, almost her position meant that she had to put a lot of effort into keeping her privacy, tremendous effort. And yet when, in 1950, when the previous Lubavitch Rebbe passed away, when her father passed away, she was the one that encouraged her husband to become Rebbe, and it was told by people that were close to them that the Rebbe was very hesitant. And of course, the one who would pay the biggest price was her. Mm-hmm. And she knew that. She knew that because she grew up in the house of the Rebbe. So she knew what it meant to have a husband who would be involved in everybody's life. And it's true. When did she see the Rebbe? Whatever it was, 2 in the morning till 2:30, you know, like a half an hour a day. And yet she was the one, because she said, very beautiful, she said, if you don't take it on, then all the legacy of all my father, grandfather, great-grandfather, what will happen with it? And to her, that mattered more than anything else. So she had such incredible principles and such an incredible way of, a lot to learn from. And her neshama should have an aliyah and generate tremendous brachas for all of us. Okay, now we are going to start Parshas Korach. So, as we said, this is a parsha. What a parsha. Okay, so the Parshas Korach is an interesting one in the sense that it is extremely dramatic. But the beginning is not so dramatic. First, we have to understand the context. The drama comes later when he's punished. And a funny thing I remember when my kids were little, and then we'll get into the learning. We were living on Woodstock Street, still remember, and it was an old semi. And there was actually, even then, there was a hole in we were just renting. There was a hole in the wood in the thing. And my Moshel, I think he was like two. He was even less than two. He was two. And one time it was around Parshas Korach, and he looks at the hole and he says, "Oh, it's Korach's hole." So I remember Korach, yeah, the hole of the, yeah. So anyways, but before we get to the hole, let's understand what happened here. Okay, so Korach. Yeah, it's a long time ago. Okay, so now on your booklets, I see you have three booklets in front of you, but I wanted to show you the first one that has this picture. It's very important to understand two things before we go inside, to understand who was Korach, then we understand a little bit of the context, as well as where he camped. Okay, so we know who Moshe and Aaron are, right? We think we know. They are, well, Moshe is the leader, Aaron is the Kohen Gadol, but to understand, in this kind, if you see Korach's family tree, we know the tribe of Levi was the holy tribe, the tribe designated for holiness. Now, Levi had really three sons, Gershon, and it only mentions one of them, Gershon, Kehas, and Merari. For some reason, Kehas was the most special, even though he's not the oldest, but he's the most special of the three sons, and from him comes very special people. So you can see Kehas has four sons, and actually, interestingly, Levi doesn't just have three sons, he has three sons and one daughter, Yocheved. Right, it's interesting. So it's if on the level of Kehas, you would have Gershon, Kehas, Merari, and Yocheved, because they are all the children of Levi. The next generation is Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel. Those are the four sons of Kehas. Amram, if you look at it now, married his aunt, right? Yocheved is the generation before. So Amram actually married his aunt Yocheved, which is not really permitted after the giving of the Torah, but that was before, so he was permitted. Anyway, actually, yes, it is permitted. It's the other way that's not. Okay, so I think that's the way it's not, right? The niece is allowed to marry an uncle, and a nephew is not allowed or shouldn't marry an aunt. Okay, anyways, Amram, we know, has three children. It mentions here Moshe and Aaron, and of course Miriam. Yitzhar has three children, Korach, Nepheg, and Zichri. And then Chevron, we don't know, it doesn't mention it because it's not relevant. But Uziel also has children, Mishael, Elitzaphan, and Sisri. Now what happened was that Moshe and Aaron were chosen to be the highest positions. And then, before we go to the next generation, Uziel, who is the youngest son of Kehas, his middle son, Elitzaphan, became what is known as the Nasi, the prince of the whole family of Kehas, right? That's what happened. Now, if you go back to who is Korach, Korach is the son of the second son. Do you see? Okay, so he's not impressed. He says, why are you skipping my father? Why don't we get some position of leadership? Why are you going all the way to the youngest son and take from his children? Why are you not choosing me? So he already had tremendous resentment based on that. He's also, if you notice, the oldest of Yitzhar's sons, so he's a Bechor. It's important to remember. That also makes it, yeah. He thinks he's very special because he's a Bechor. If you go to the next generation, we see that Aaron's children, Nadav, Avihu, Elazar, and Isamar. So Elazar becomes the next Kohen Gadol, as we know. And that's another thing. Kairach says, it's not enough, Aaron, that you're taking it. Why are you giving it on to the next generation? I should at least be a Kohen in the meantime, and whatever. Okay, so you can already see where some of the... Go to the next page before we go inside. I'll show you one more important. I know we've done this when we started Bamidbar, but it's important to see this is how they camped in the desert. And it's very, very important because of this story. So there are three circles of names. The outside circle are the tribes, right? The general, the Machane, the whole Machane Yisrael, right? Where the Jewish people camped. Then we come into the Machane Leviya, it's called the tribe of Levi, which, as we said, had three sons, Kehas. Here it says Kehas is on the south, Gershon on the west, Merari in the north. And then on the side is Moshe, Aaron, and his sons. So, you know, I actually even feel bad I didn't share it. Okay, so that's a very good question. So each one of them had different work. So when it comes to the work, I'm not sure, but it's more to do with when they carried the Mishkan. So Kehas carried the actual vessels, which was the most special of all the three. And Gershon, yes, but the special people carrying the Aron, and then all the other, yeah, exactly right. Whereas Gershon was the, one of them was the curtains, and one of them is the actual boards. So yeah, Merari, I think, is the boards. Sorry, so you see here, Moshe, Aaron, and his sons, they are, even though they're part of Kehas, you see, but they get their own special side. Interestingly, who was near, who were the neighbors who camped near Moshe? Yehuda. You see the tribe of Yehuda, the tribe of Yisachar, and the tribe of Zvulun. You can see that. And it says, and in the middle, of course, is the Mishkan. But it says that we know, and we all know, Yehuda became the leaders. The kings come from Yehuda. But we are the greatest Torah scholars of the whole Jewish nation from the tribe of Yisachar, because they were the neighbors of Moshe and Aaron. You see how it affects them. But if you go down to Kehas, which includes Korach, who's next to him? The tribe of Reuven. Now, Reuven, you see Reuven? He's there under him. They were camping very close to each other. They would have met each other more often. You know, they would have seen each other. They would have mixed with each other. And the effect is, unfortunate, a negative effect. And let's see, we'll see how Rashi will tell. So now, based on this, we can understand a little bit of what happens. Okay, let's see now some of the psukim. Okay, so if you turn the page of the same booklet we were with the diagrams. Yeah, Lisa, that one. So turn to the third page and we'll see the psukim. I want to see the story, what's going on. Yeah, let's see. Okay. Vayikach Korach, so that's how it starts. And Korach took Ben Yitzhar, the son of Yitzhar, the son of Ben Kehas, the son of Kehas, Ben Levi, the son of Levi. Now, who is with him? These are important people. We'll see in a minute who they are. Dasan and Aviram, and they are Bnei Eliav, the sons of Eliav. And Oin Ben Peles, that's on the third page of your booklet, because there's a big Rashi in between. And who are Dasan, Aviram, and Oin? They are all from the tribe of Reuven. Okay, so you can see already, Korach takes a few people with him. Well, we'll see what the word Vayikach means. But obviously, he's going to stage a rebellion. We know about that. And he wants support. Who does he get to support him? These people. Why? And this is what we want to understand. First of all, what's Korach's problem? So we see a little bit already. We already saw from just the history of what his problem was. But what's all these other people's problem? They're not Korach, right? And what is it that they're doing? They're going to come and stand before Moshe. So let's just see, before we go inside, Vayakumu Lifnei Moshe. See, that's on page 192, right? It's Pasuk Beis. And they stood before Moshe, Va'anoshim Mibnei Yisrael, with men of the children of Israel, Chamishim Umasayim Nisiei Eda. And it's amazing how it describes them. First of all, even Korach gives the whole Yichus. He's special, right? And now not only is he special, but the people, these people from the Jewish people are 250. Who are they? They are amazing. Nisiei, they're the princes of the assembly. Kriye, they are men of renown. Anshe Shem is men of renown. They are summoned for a meeting. In other words, these were special people. So he didn't just come on his own. He made sure, as we know, when people want to try to make a little bit of trouble, what they do, either they talk to their neighbors, their friends, whatever it is, they gather a whole group, because there's nothing more powerful than when you come in numbers. You come on your own, you're a nebach, you have one complaint, disgruntled, nobody will look at you. Here, Moshe, here Korach is coming, but not just with anybody. He manages to find the most special, renowned, honored people amongst the Jewish people. And what do they do? As he says, Vayikalu al Moshe v'al Aaron, and they gather together against Moshe and Aaron. Vayomru aleim, and they say to them, Rav lachem, it is much for you. Ki kol ha'eda kulam kedoshim, all of the Jewish people, everybody is holy. And he says, ubesoicham Hashem, and Hashem is amongst them. Umadua tisnasu, why do you exalt, why do you elevate yourself? Al kahal Hashem, on the congregation of Hashem. And just one more pasuk to see how Moshe reacts to this. In this pasuk, it's not clear, but we have to analyze what are they saying. But you can see they're complaining, and they're not impressed. They're saying something about Moshe doing something which takes leadership or assumes that he's more important than everybody else. Vayishma Moshe, Moshe hears, Vayipal al panav, and he falls on his face. You can see that Moshe realizes this is trouble. Okay, because we know that Moshe has been approached already many, many times by the Jewish people with complaints, and you don't see this reaction usually. He might get angry, he might get upset, he might answer them, talk to them, or he turns to Hashem right away. Sometimes he takes the complaint on board, and he says, Hashem, yeah, look, it's right, you know, they shouldn't be thirsty. But here, he falls on his face, almost like this is something that's too much for him. Very interesting. Obviously, on a simple level, we can just say this is the first time that you have a personal complaint against Moshe. And this is very difficult for Moshe, obviously. This is like he's just totally undermining who he is. As if Moshe, and we know from when we learned, how it took Moshe, Hashem, a whole week to convince Moshe to assume leadership. It's not what Moshe wanted. He never wants it. It's the most difficult position possible. And here these people, what do? They're coming and, boy, oh boy, complaining and knocking him down. Okay, let's go right back to the first page. Not the first page of the booklet, but Rashi. Let's understand a little bit. We have to understand a little bit of the depth of what's going on. So it'll take a little bit, I hope you don't mind, take a bit of time to explore because there's different angles. But Vayikach, first the words Vayikach Korach. Because it's interesting. It says he took, but doesn't say what he took. Do you realize? It just says he took. Right? And then we have all these people. So here, let's see Rashi. First Rashi is important. We'll explore it in a minute. So Rashi says, Vayikach Korach, Parsha zu, Yofe nidreshes, B'midrash Rabbi Tanchuma. So first Rashi tells us that this Parsha is very well explained and expounded upon in the Medrash of Rabbi Tanchuma. But he doesn't go into it, Rashi, yet. But why does he say that's interesting? Because it makes us realize right away, this is such a hard parsha, and you cannot just read it and think you're going to understand what's going on. Even just on a simple level, for us, when we look at it, to try and understand how the Jewish people who have just received the Torah and seen who Moshe is, done all those miracles, gone and taken them out of Mitzrayim, split the sea, went up on Har Sinai, and we know what happened. Remember how it describes how Moshe looked when he came down from Har Sinai? He had this like ray of light. He's a holy man, and Aaron who loved everybody. These are people who were dedicated to the people and loved them and were so holy. It's very hard to understand the story. And it's not, and we shouldn't forget that, even though we'll give all the explanations. But we have to first realize it shouldn't sit well with us. Machlokes should never sit well with anybody. No matter all the explanations and all the rationalizations, that's not a good thing. Sometimes there's no choice, I'm not saying, but it should never sit well. It shouldn't be something that we become comfortable with or that we go to in the first instance, for sure not, right? So that's how, right away, Rashi tells us, you need a lot of deeper explanation. It's very difficult to understand what's happening here. Okay, but let's understand, what did he take? Vayikach Korach. Korach separated himself, Rashi says. That's how he translated it, which means, who did he take? Lokach es atzmai. He took himself. And what did he do with himself? Litzad ach echad. He took himself to one side. So it's an expression, almost like a poetic way of saying it. What did he take? He took himself. He took himself and separated himself from everybody else, meaning especially from Moshe and Aaron, and at the moment from the rest of the Jewish people. And why? Liyos nechlak mitaycha eda, to separate himself from the assembly of Israel, la'oirer al hakahuna, by raising objections regarding the priesthood. V'zehu shetirgem Unkelus, and he actually proves this, he says that's how Unkelus translates it. Unkelus uses the word v'ispaleg, and he separated himself. So, here we have... Sorry, everybody here. Okay. No, I'm sorry. Here it is. Okay. So then he says like this. He separated himself from the rest of the assembly by sustaining a dispute. This is actually interesting because it's not just that he has like a little complaint, you know, and he voices it. But we know he flares this up into a massive thing. It says, we'll see later, but it says the Medrash tells us that at the time of Korach, when he got to his height, to the peak of the Machlekes, almost everybody was on his side. That's how convincing and charismatic and terrible he was, actually, in a way. But it's quite interesting, as we know, when it comes to this idea of dispute and making division, unfortunately, it's not so hard. Harder is to make peace, much harder. Much harder than dispute. But anyway, let's see how it goes. So he says that's one way. So Vayikach, he took himself. Then he says there's another in the brackets. He says, alternatively, Vayikach Korach means Moshach Rashi Sanhedrin Shebahem Bidvarim. It means, Vayikach means he drew them with words. In other words, he convinced everybody. That's what Vayikach means. To convince other people to bring across his point of view, and that's how he took them. So he, you know, sort of schlepped them, and now they were on his side, and that's what Korach did. Now Rashi comments about the fact that it gives his whole fantastic lineage, right? So it goes Ben Yitzhar, Ben, as we say, Ben Kahas, Ben Levi, right? All the father, the grandfather, the great-grandfather. Interestingly, who's missing? The great-grandfather, the great-great-Yaakov. Yeah, doesn't say Yaakov. So Rashi says, V'loi hiskir ben Yaakov, but it stops by Levi, and it doesn't say the son of Yaakov. Why? Shebikesh rachamim al shmai. Yaakov himself saw this in, you know, with his Ruach HaKodesh, right? He had divine inspiration. And he knew that ultimately, from his grandchildren, there will be this machlekes. So what does he ask for? Unfortunately, sometimes we don't need divine inspiration to see that. That's a sad thing. But anyways, he didn't want something. What didn't he want? And he actually asked Hashem. He says, don't put my name with it. At least save me from having my name mentioned associated with Korach. I just want to tell you the interest. Let me just finish the Rashi and I'll show you. He says, Shalai yizachar shmai al machluktam, that his name shouldn't be part of their machlekes. And he says the words, B'kholam al teichad kvaydi. He says it actually when he blessed Levi at the end before he passed away, with their congregation, do not join my name. V'heicha niskar shmai al Korach. But where do we yes see the name of Yaakov yes mentioned with Korach? Much later in Tanakh, the last sefer, Divrei Hayomim, it says, Behis yachsom al haduchan, when the lineage of Korach's descendants is given regarding the platform meaning to say they relate Levim. So they used to stand in the Mishkan and sing. That's what they would do. They were very, very talented and they used to sing they were the ones who conducted all the singing. So at that point, these are the descendants of Korach. Over there, when it mentions the names, it says, Shenemar, Ben Evyosaf, Ben Korach, Ben Yitzhar. Then it says, Ben Kahas, Ben Levi, Ben Yisrael. Now, interesting. Why? It's a fascinating thing. What is Rashi telling us? That the truth is, it should have said Yaakov's name here. Because there it does. In other words, his name is associated with this family, and that's the way the lineage is usually told. The fact that it says it there and not here shows that Yaakov didn't want to be part when the story of Korach is happening. He doesn't want to be part of it. Later, these are his descendants. So you see, they did Shuvla. So that's a whole different, you know, set of family, if you want to say. There Yaakov's okay with his name. But here he does not want to be part, and he wasn't. Hashem did a kindness and didn't make him part. Now let's see a Rashi, according to Rashi, the next page. I want to see two more beautiful things in the Rashi. These people in the first pasuk who joined Kairach, who are they? Dasan and Aviram. So who's Dasan and Aviram? So he says, Bishvil Shahaya Shevet Ruven Shriya Bechaniyasam Teimana. Okay, so we actually said this one, but I just want to read one line from it. So we mentioned that why is it that Dasan and Aviram join? Because they are from the tribe of Ruven, right? And what do we know? Ruven were on the south. And we say, Shachin Lekasu Banav, they were neighbor to Kas and his sons. Hachinim Teimana, who also camped on the south. Nishtatfu im Kairach, so they joined Kairach b'machluktai in his machlekes, and here we have the famous words, Oy le Rasha v'oy le Shcheinai. Woe, like Nebach for the Rasha, but Nebach for his neighbor. This is a very, very important, profound lesson that comes through the story of Kairach. In both ways we have to look at it. As a human being, as a person, we have to be careful who we mix with. We could think we're very strong, we're principled, we know what's right, we're not going to be influenced, nobody's going to make us do the wrong thing. Doesn't work that way. You mix with the wrong people too much, it is inevitable that you will be influenced. These were very special people from the tribe of Reuven. And nevertheless, just because of the fact that they were together all the time, it has an effect. And that's Oyle Rasha, Oyle Shechina. So on the one hand, you have to be careful who you mix with. And on the other hand also, you have to be careful of who you are because of the impact that you have on others around you. So sometimes we might want to make the wrong decisions and think, so I could do what I want. It's only me. No, you affect the people around you. So it goes both ways. Oyle Rasha and Oyle Shechina. So as we can see from here, a very powerful thing, be very, very careful. And on the flip side, we know that with Moshe, how the positive effect, so that also shows us something beautiful, that if we want to and we choose to do the right thing, we can have a positive effect on the people around us. And if we feel a little bit weak, hang around the right people. It also makes a difference. So it goes both ways also there. Okay, so let's see what happens. Who are his names? Let's see what he says. Now Rashi starts right away to understand what's happening here. Because we have to understand the story. What did Kairach see lachloki Moshe? Right? What's his problem with Moshe? So he says, Niskana al Nisiyusai, he was jealous of the princely position, as we saw in our paper, of who Elitzafin, the son of Uziel. And we saw that who was Uziel? He was the fourth son of Kahas, and he's upset. Why is his family being skipped? And he says, Shemino Moshe Nasi, Moshe appointed him as the prince, Al Bnei Kahas, over the sons of Kahas, Al Piadibar. We know, of course, he didn't do it on his own. He did it according to what Hashem commanded him. But nevertheless, Kairach didn't like it, and he blamed Moshe that Moshe was doing things on his own. This was really the biggest key, if you want to see, in the whole machlekes, is the fact that Kairach suspects Moshe that he makes decisions on his own and not necessarily directly by Hashem. You can see, he says, what happens, because this, as we saw the story, he says like this, Shenemar b'nei Kahas, he says, the sons of my father were four. Shenemar b'nei Kahas, right? And he goes, let me just see how he says it. Amram is the Bechar, Natlu Shnei Banav, Gdula, his two sons get greatness, right? One is the king, Moshe, one is the Kayin Gadol, Aaron. And then Mi Roi Litoles Hashniya, who should fit to take the second place? In other words, who should be the prince, the Nasi? Loyani, isn't it I? Shani ben Yitzar, for I am the son of Yitzar. Shehu Sheni La Amram, who's the second to Amram. Vuhumina Nasi, and yet what did Moshe do? He appointed as Nasi as Ben Ochiv HaKatan, Mikulam, the son of the youngest child of Kahas, and that's not right. So that's what he says, Hareini Chaylik Olav, behold, I will dispute with him, Umevatel es Dvarav, and nullify his words. So what does Kairach do? As we said, he can't do it on his own. So Ma'asa, what did he do? Amad v'kanas, he rose up and gathered together, Masayim v'chamishim Roshei Sanhedrin. It's interesting. He realized that his problem that he had with Moshe, even though you might have logic to it, it's not going to be easy to win over at all the people, or even to get a word into Moshe, right? And not to be condemned by the people if he would complain. So it's amazing what he does. He goes to the most important people, the heads of the Sanhedrin. It's quite incredible. These are very special people, and he manages to convince them of his claim. Also showing us something, it's so incredible. The brain rationalizing is such a dangerous thing, because you could rationalize almost anything. And if a person has the gift, the charismatic gift and the gift of words and the ability, and some people do, to present something, they can present something so skewed, but after a while you start to say, oh, they have a point, and you start to think the way they do. And this is what Kairach managed to do. It's a very powerful lesson for us to realize that we have to be extremely, extremely careful when it comes to being influenced by anything that's negative. It's not hard to be influenced, as we say. It's much easier than we think. Much, much easier. Okay, so he convinces them. And what does he do? He gathers them together, the 250 heads of the courts. Reuben, and he says most of them were from the tribe of Levi, who were his neighbors, and that's Elitzur ben Shteyer. And who were they? As we know, the Nasi of the tribe of, of the tribe of Reuven, which was Elitzur ben, the son of Shteyer, and his colleagues. And then he says, let me just see what else he says about this. Now, I just want to show you, and this we'll get into later. We're not going to go into too much in depth today. But initially, how does he present his claim to Moshe? Now, if he would come to Moshe and just say, oh, you appointed, you know, my cousin, the younger one, and I'm the one that should be appointed, that's petty, and it sounds so selfish, and it sounds like Nebuch, you know, that's not a claim that he could come with. So what does he say? And he doesn't just come on, like, with saying. He comes with a whole show, okay, an experience. So what does Kairach do? And this is a fascinating one. It says Kairach comes like this, and I saw in one of the Midrashim, it says it was his wife's idea. Now, we just learned in the parasha that we just finished, Shlach, remember we learned about the tzitzis, right? Yeah. Okay, and we said on the tzitzis is a garment usually made of wool, and on this, you know, then you attach these strings, and the main string is the one made of tcheles, right? That was the highlight of it all. So what do? They say like this. He comes to Moshe, and he says, "Ulahalan hu aimer." Okay, so let me just see. V'hil bishun, he takes talisos shekulan tcheles, on all the 250 men and himself and Dasan and Aviram and all of them. He puts them all in a talis which was made entirely of tcheles. I don't know how he got so much tcheles, but maybe he used it all up. That's why we don't have any. But anyways, he took all the, and he made these talisim and he dyed them all with tcheles. Ba'u v'amdu lifnei Moshe. They came and stood before Moshe. Amrulai, they said to him, Talis shekula shel tcheles. So they're asked, as if they're asking him an innocent question. A talis which is entirely made of tcheles, does it need chayeves betzitzis? Does it also need that one string of tcheles to come out of it? Like, isn't that ridiculous? If the whole thing is made of tcheles, what would one string accomplish? And Moshe says, yeah, it does need chayeves, it needs. And they started, well, chayeves, like chayev, it's obligated. He said, yeah, it needs, you need to put tzitzis on it. They started to laugh at Moshe. If the whole garment is tcheles, remember we said the tcheles was the blue that reminded you of the sky and it reminded you of Hashem. Now, if you're wearing a whole garment that's reminding you of Hashem, what's one string going to make a difference? Why does it need it? It's not important. And they start to laugh. And the Mefarshim tells, what does it mean? What they were trying to do, in a way, was not just to mock Moshe, but to undermine him by saying, look, he's ridiculous, and everything he's teaching is ridiculous. It means this is not from Hashem. Hashem is not ridiculous like this. This must mean that he's making these things up himself. And he's undermining Moshe before all of the people. We know, Rashi doesn't mention it, but the Medrash says it was a second question, right? The famous second question. And it's actually hinted to in the Pasuk because it says that they were standing by the tents. What was the second question? They said, if a house is full of svarim, right? Full of sidurim, full of svarim, full of holy books. Does it need a mezuzah on the door? And we know, what does a mezuzah have? Just a few parshiyos, right? Moshe says, yeah, it needs a mezuzah. So it's ridiculous. The whole thing is like a mezuzah, right? It's one big mezuzah. Why does it need a little mezuzah on the door? again, mocking him and undermining. And we have to, we'll learn a little bit deeper about what that claim was, but it's quite scary to see, again, the power that if one individual who has a one, you know, disgruntled thing can do to a whole nation, if they choose to, and if people are not aware of what's, you know, the, as we say, it just like takes on a life of its own. And that's what they did. And it was quite a scary situation, but I just wanted to see, okay, I want to show you something. There's another booklet in front of you, because I want to understand something before we go. And next week we'll do probably more than the Mefarshim, but I just want to show you something quite beautiful. This is a thing from the Rebbe. Let's see if I could find my sitter here. If I have mine. Okay, so if you look at, you see on your thing, there was three booklets. One of them looks like this. I think I wrote just number one on it. Okay, I'm just going to do some of this inside. And I'll show you something beautiful here.
Page 1?
Yeah, it starts, it's really like page 191. I had a little one on top. Okay. So, I'll just be like I say, we'll go through a few things inside and a few things orally, because this is to help us, even though I know there's a little bit jumping the gun, but to understand, because it's very difficult to learn the story and not know what's really going on over here. Because we're talking here, Kairach was not an ordinary person. Remember we mentioned last week, he was very wealthy. I just want to mention something, I forgot, and I saw it this week again, about him being wealthy. Okay, so a lot of the Jewish people were wealthy, right? Remember we said they got so much wealth at Kriyas Yamsuf, you know, they took all the wealth from the Egyptians. What's so unique about Kairach? So I'll tell you two things that are unique. Kairach was from the tribe of Levi. And one fascinating thing is that when the Jewish people left Egypt, remember how they asked all the neighbors for their things? The tribe of Levi didn't, because they didn't work. So they weren't, so to speak, entitled to compensation, if you want to say. So they actually already were poor then. It remained always. Tribe of Levi, it says, later on became teachers. Teachers are poor. It says that. They never, and they didn't even have a piece of land. So they didn't have property. So the tribe of Levi was known not to be very financially, you know, on the top of the rung. They were more the spiritual tribe who were giving and teaching Torah and did with little. So they didn't get from the Egyptians. But when it came to Kriyas Yamsuf, they were also permitted to take, you know, from the spoils. But it says that since, as we know, at the Kriyas Yamsuf, there were such revelations of godliness. And the tribe of Levi being such a spiritual tribe, all they were doing was trying to understand and learn, that they were almost neglecting to take. They took very little, because that's not where their energy was. But the one person, Kairach, loved money. He had some people born with a love of money. And that's what it says. Only you have to really love money to become really rich. You know, that's like a Yiddish saying. My father used to say, you have to really love it. That's the only people that really, I mean, unless they have, I don't know, a big Yerusha from somewhere. But usually you have to really love it to really become very wealthy. Kairach loved money. Even in Egypt, it says that he worked himself up to becoming almost an advisor, a treasurer in Egypt, because he loved money, wanted to be around money. And at one point, he found something that Yosef had left behind, some kind of his own bank account, and he took it, because he felt, why not? No, it doesn't belong to the Egyptians, so he already took it then. And then by the Yam Suf, because he loved money, he wasn't distracted by all the holy revelations. He was collecting tremendous amount of money. And Kairach, we know, became one of the, not Stam, but the wealthiest man that ever lived. Then it says, on the flip side of that, he was also a man who loved to learn. And he did. And he was a brilliant man. And he was a man who, as you can see, very charismatic, but not in a terrible way, really. In a certain way, it was a gift. He was a man who loved to learn. He wanted, in his mind, it was a bit distorted, but he felt he was a holy man, right? He was going to do good things with his money, whatever it was. He was a special man. Now, we have to understand how a person from that tribe and a person of that caliber and from that family, how did he fall so low? And what is the story with him here? So let's understand it a little bit deeper. Okay, so let's see here. We'll see a nice way to understand Kairach before we get to the not nice way, which we'll analyze as we get in the story. Okay, so if you look on the first column, it says, first of all, we say Parshas Kairach, right? There's many, many things, and we know. So the name of the Parsha is Parshas Kairach. So the first question, Umisaireres shaili. See, there's a little line there. Pshuta, a simple question that anybody can ask. Hayitachin, like, how is it possible? Sheparsha shlema, that a complete parsha, b'tayra, tikare kairach, will be called kairach. Shmai shel rasha, right? We're saying he was terrible, and he did a terrible thing, and yet we name the parsha after him. Sounds a bit strange. Everything in Torah is holy. And what do we know? We say like this, shalai, and we say not only that, but Kairach didn't do tshuva, which he says, and we know what it says, shame Rishayim Yirkov, and loy maskinan bishmayu, right? The name of Rishayim should be wiped out. That's why we always say, yemach shemay. That's where it comes from. You erase the name of somebody who was wicked. You don't even want to say his name. You don't. And why we name a parasha entire after Kairach? Something sounds a bit funny. We have to understand what's going on over here. Interesting, it says, Bolok is also named after not a good person, but he wasn't Jewish, so it's a little bit different. Because a Jew is choosing to do the wrong thing and should know better, so that also makes the question a little bit harder. But Bolok, we'll have to learn when we get there why. But let's see over here. Let's go down. I want to go down to where it says Vahabior Bazet. You see the explanation. So we're going to go to the next page. Next page, Machlaikes Kairach Haisab Bichlal. Let's see. So here we're analyzing something in a little bit of a deeper way. What really prompted what, on page C, it's 192 on the top, what motivated Kairach to fight, to argue with Moshe, to make this division? Ritzainai Liyais Kayin Gadol, he wanted to be the Kohen Gadol. So some of us think, oh, just because he wanted a position of leadership. No. Ubikashtim gan kahuna. It says, he asked also for kahuna. Mevakshim kahuna gedela, seeking kahuna gedela. Hainu. Sheratza liyais bedarga nailis yaiser. There was a part of him that wanted to be very holy. He wanted the privilege of going into the Holy of Holies, to be one with Hashem, to be able to have the tremendous revelation that takes place there. Ad la'ayfen shel avdala, to the point of separation, right, from the rest of the Jewish people. Kedar gosay shel kayin gadol shenemar bay, vayavdel lakdishay kodesh kadashim. We know what it says about the kayin gadol. He's separate, he is Holy of Holies, and he gets to go into the Holy of Holies. And Kairach had a very strong aspiration. He had a yearning to be very holy, to be holy in a sense where you can have such tremendous connection to Hashem. And he says, Ve'inyan, this concept, Haratza, and the will, to be on this level of Kohen Gadol, who bevadai davar toiv, this is definitely a good thing. As we know, Moshe Rabbeinu said himself, Afani roitze bekach, oh, I also want that. You think, oh, I didn't want that? And originally Moshe was supposed to be, but it was given to Aaron, right? I also want to be Kohen Gadol. Shegam hu ratza liyais bedarga shel Kohen Gadol. Rather, but he wasn't, because there's only one Kohen Gadol. He says, v'yumtach yoyser mailas kairach, and it's explained even in it, like, you can even understand it even more. Al piyam mevur b'lokotei teirid parasha senu. So it's explained very deeply, the idea that shayrish ha'inyan b'machleikes kairach, the root, when we're talking in the deeper parts of Torah, what's the root of the machleikes? What's really the deep part? What happened? That the truth is, in the future, shela asid yihiyu ha'levi'im kaihanim. In the future, all of the tribe of Levi will really be Kaihanim. Kaihanim is interesting. It's a fascinating thing because a Levi is actually Gevura. That's what a Levi is. And a Kayin is Chesed. That's what it says. Now, nowadays, what is higher? Chesed. I mean, that's how we look at it. And the truth is, for us, it's more palatable. I mean, we all want just kindness and giving. And, you know, it's fantastic, wonderful. Gevura, which we always consider severity, but Gevura in its source comes from a higher source. It says in the time of Mashiach, of the three patriarchs, we are going to say about Yitzchak, Ki Ata Avinu, you are our father. Not about Avram, and of course they're all our fathers. They always remain our father. But who will be the higher one now? Avram and Yaakov? But when Mashiach comes, Yitzchak. Then we will truly be able to relate to the concept of Gevura. It's hard for us to understand that now, because we're looking at it from our mindset. But Gevura obviously takes a much greater level of godliness, because it takes some, as we know, it's very interesting. Let's say if somebody wants to teach, let's say, a second grader, or they want to teach an eighth grader, and they want to take a very difficult mathematical concept, it is actually much more difficult to simplify something and to simplify and simplify to the level that even the simplest person can understand it. That actually takes somebody who really understands it. When you explain something to somebody who's like on your level, it's okay if you don't understand it so well. But in order to be able to simplify something, you gotta really, really have it. For Hashem to simplify, which means that's what Gevura is, where he contracts and contracts and holds himself back, and yet is it able to relate to the simplest, so to speak, and the furthest from him, that comes from a very high level of godliness. So when Mashiach will come, really who will be the prime will be the concept of a Levi. And Kairach said, oh, I want it to be the time of Mashiach, that all of us Levim should be what we call Kaihanim now. But he was jumping the gun. It wasn't time yet. It wasn't possible yet. There was a lot that needed to be done before that. And this is what Moshe tried to explain to him, but he didn't buy it. That was the problem. Now, he didn't buy it. Moshe also tried to say, I also want to be a Kohen, but I can't. But he didn't buy that either. That was a bit of a problem, okay? But the yearning is a very good thing. And I know we're going to continue. I feel bad. I thought we would do it all this week, but I don't want to go over time. And I just want to share with you very quickly, just to leave you with this thought, and we're going to do it next week more in depth to understand. The yearning is a good thing. And what we have to remember, that's why the name is Kairach. I know when we think of Kairach, right away we say Machlokes, right? That's what we think. Oh, a person. Put that aside for a moment. Think of somebody who yearned for something higher. And we have to realize that in life, even though it is very important for us to accept who we are, and that's for sure important, and we know that's part of B'tochen, and we do, and accept our life, but there's nothing wrong with yearning for more, even if we know we won't be able to attain it. Because the yearning actually makes us grow even within what we are. Because as we know, whatever you aspire to, that's where your will is. That's where you associate with. And as we originally said, who do you associate with? People who you want to be like. So if you yearn for that, you'll try and find people like that to be with them. You'll be influenced in the positive way. You'll be in that surrounding. So yearning to be a Kohen Gadol is not a bad thing. But we also have to know our place and do what we have to do. At the same time, I know in this world nowadays, everything is about being comfortable and everybody has to be, you know, like nowadays in psychology, they have the big thing, you know, like, don't make yourself uncomfortable. It's not such a bad thing. Discomfort is not a bad thing, especially spiritually. If a person is comfortable, forget it. They're stuck. They're nothing. They don't go anywhere. So being uncomfortable, which means to yearn and even to know that you can't get there, that's also a good thing. That's a beautiful thing. And Hashem actually appreciates that and even names a whole parsha after somebody who ended up not doing the right thing with it, but just to give us that lesson. So we'll leave it at that. And next week we'll develop a little bit more.